evening and welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is Iraqi novelist, artist, and political commentator Haifa Zangana. Zangana is a former prisoner of Saddam Hussein's regime and has been living in exile in London since 1976. She's a contributor to The Guardian of London and the author of several novels, including her biographical novel, Through the Vast Halls of Memory. She recently published a work of nonfiction called City of Widows, an Iraqi woman's account of war and resistance, published by Seven Stories Press. I'm speaking to Haifa Zangana by phone from Chicago, one of the stops on her current North American book tour. Haifa Zangana, welcome to Out of Bounds. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me. Thank you.
Now, I want to begin with the fact that in 1958, when you were 8 years old, Iraq was celebrating its freedom from British colonial rule, which began in 1917. Do you have memories of that time?
Oh, yes. I was a child of the age of seven, and It was the most colorful time of my life and other people, my family, neighborhood, the streets of the city. There were absolute celebration, and we never seen anything like it before, and all the years after also. It was a time when Iraqis felt that they own their country totally. They own the resources. They can do what they like at last, and they can achieve everything they were dreaming of. It was a time of jubilation, achievement, and almost dreams coming true. That was 1958 for us.
Mm-hmm. And of course, all of this changed in the 1970s as Saddam Hussein and his Ba'ath Party came to power. Tell us how this affected you personally.
Well, the change was gradual, because to start with, in the early 70s, the regime was just trying to, the Ba'ath Party was just trying to establish itself, and it started by building some parts of the country. The construction was going on, the economy, also the influence of the oil then, the amount of money, the revenues. Most of it being spent on the construction and building the economy of Iraq, the education, the health service. So it was the gradual process of the development of the state, which being carried on over decades and decades. But the main problem was with the Ba'ath Party, and after that, while Saddam Hussein himself became the leader of the party, was the dictatorship. And the lack of political freedom, which led to the brutality, to the political oppression, which led also to the control on the media, freedom of speech, gatherings. It started by one thing and led to many other things. And we were always, and perhaps this is something which I've noticed recently, even in many other countries, using war on terror or global war on terror, we were almost treated in the same way, that we were surrounded, according to the regime, by enemies. So we have to always be on the alert, because the enemy might attack us. Terrorists might do this. This neighbor will attack our achievements. They don't like us, so we have to do this and that. And this, the whole country been almost collapsed because of that. You have to fight the enemy. There is an enemy to be fought all the time. And this is how a few generations of Iraqi people grow up. They were part of a war machine almost, especially between 1980-1988 during the Iraq-Iran war, which cost both countries almost over 650,000 killed the people of both countries.
So fear was being used as a way to control the population.
It was a very, very effective tool to manipulate the people and creating this environment of fear all the time, and you are threatened. And when you are threatened, you lose your capability to see things clearly. And on the other hand, also, that will stop you fighting the regime or stop you trying to work to change anything in a substantial way in the country.
Now, you were a student of pharmacy at the University of Baghdad when you joined the struggle against Saddam Hussein and ended up in prison and tortured and so on. Well, what kind of tools were you using to struggle against him at that time?
Well, we were part of a political party or a faction of the Communist Party, but not the mainstream, because we believe that the mainstream party was following the agenda of the Soviet Union, which did not represent Iraqi people. But we were a faction believing both democracy and socialism. More or less, it's something like what's happening in Latin America. We're seeking different way. And we were believing that Iraqi people deserve something better than this dictatorship, and also better than this regime. The Ba'ath Party had very bloody history in Iraq, you see, since 1963, the coup d'etat in 1963, and the almost killing and execution of the leaders of the 1958 revolution. So we already had a taste of what they can do in the future. We knew what's going to happen, or at least we've seen further than what the other people saw. So we took part in this group, and we were trying to overthrow the regime. We felt, because the mainstream political Communist Party was in negotiation with the Ba'ath Party to form a national unity government, and it was backed totally by the Soviet Union then. So they worked on, we were arrested, some of the groups were executed. I was one of the lucky people who survived prison and torture, and in the end, I escaped Iraq.
Yes, you went to Britain in 1976.
Yes, yeah. Mm-hmm. But mm-hmm. Before that, I spent 1 year in moving between Syria and Lebanon. I was working with Palestinians, Red Crescent, and also with the camps of the Palestinians until the beginning of the civil war in Lebanon. And mm-hmm. I thought, well, I just had enough of wars, and it's about time I think I need a space to think clearly about what I'm going to do.
Mm-hmm.
So I moved on to London.
In your book, City of Widows, you talk a lot about the history of Iraq, and let's talk about what we call the first Gulf War in 1991 when Iraq invaded Kuwait. What was the state of the country at that time?
Well, it was, we just finished with Iraq-Iran War, which lasted 8 years,
mm-hmm.
and people at that time, they were so desperate for peace that, and I heard so many Iraqis say, we were even willing, when we heard Saddam Hussein announcing the end of the war, we were even willing to worship him. Has he carried on in a peaceful way? I think people were willing to forgive him for all the crimes he committed then. But then immediately after that, we were led to another occupation, to another war.
Mm-hmm.
And he launched it now against an Arabic country, a neighbor country. Okay, I mean, many people think, well, he being led foolishly to this war, but it was a war, and it was an occupation of another country. And also led to the first Gulf War and the bombardment of Iraq for 43 days. Baghdad was, the destruction was immense. Everything, the national electricity grid, the water purification plants, schools, universities, museums, everything, more or less, certain degrees, they were bombarded. So Iraq was left paralyzed. Yet, to the credit of Iraqi people, we have to admit and admire Iraqi people, because within 6 months of the end of that, Iraqis managed to rebuild more or less everything that the destruction caused, and including electricity and water and schools, as if to defy the outside, this kind of barbaric bombardment then.
Mm-hmm.
This is how, what we left with is one war after the other. And the bombardment did not stop. From the 90s until 2003, it was like twice weekly Baghdad used to be bombarded. Also, Iraq in general was subjected to the sanctions.
I was going to bring that up.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. It's 13 years of sanctions by the blessing of the United Nations, pushed by the United States and the British government. And it's been described by even some of the United Nations officials as a systematic genocide against Iraqi people. We lost something like 500,000 children devastated. The whole country was devastated. It affected every single aspect of the daily life in Iraq. People have to rethink. And you see that at that time, Iraqis started to question the idea of democracy. What kind of outside world would the democracy that put Iraqis under siege for 13 years, not allowing them even to import pencils for writing, because they are saying, well, the pencils could have been used for dual action, could have been used for manufacturing of weapons of mass destruction. Everything was affected. Medical journals we weren't allowed to have inside Iraq. Magazines, books. Our students stopped going. We weren't allowed to study outside the country. So the siege touched every single aspect of our daily life and weakened Iraqi people rather than the Ba'ath regime, actually. It's left us almost in such a weak state. Perhaps, I mean, now Iraq is thinking, perhaps, well, that was the idea to prepare for the invasion of 2003. We are so weak that they can really come, and the swift occupation of a couple of weeks, and that's it, because we were too weak to fight back or to resist the occupation then.
And can you explain, with this backdrop of sanctions having devastated the country, what was the feeling of the Iraqi people during the buildup of this 2003 war? You knew it was coming. How were people reacting to it?
Well, they were so desperate. First of all, protect themselves. It's protecting their livelihood. They were trying, women in particular, what they were doing is trying to save on powder milk, have foods, have some oil in the houses, digging wells because they were fears that they don't have enough water. So in more of houses in the urban areas, we have still until now the wells in our gardens. Various ways of trying to protect themselves, but also they were dreading the bombardment, you see, the bombardment which is really indiscriminate against people, and the fear, the inside feel of using weapons, chemical weapons, using various unconventional weapons. I remember very well that my niece, who was due to have her baby in over 1 month time, I rang Baghdad trying to make sure that she's all right. And that was exactly 2 days before the occupation. I rang saying, how is Luma? How is she now? Is she okay? And he, my brother said, well, she just had her baby. I said, how come? It's another month. And he said, well, Iraqi women are queuing, young women, pregnant. They are queuing in the hospital to have cesareans because of the fear that may not be able to reach hospitals after that. This is how horrendous it was, and also the fear because your son, your brother, being a soldier in the army, and in case of Iraqis, it's not voluntary. You don't join the army because you want to join the army. It's compulsory, and you'll be punished if you're not. You'll be executed if you escape or anything. You're punished in a horrendous way. So our sons and fathers and brothers, they were in the army, and we were fearing for them, for their safety. What is it for? How is it, the war is going to end? How it's going to affect everything? And it went on and on for, I mean, the preparation for the war is over a year. And this was a very, very dark period on Iraqi people.
Do you think people believed what turned out we know now to be propaganda, that the U.S. was going to get rid of this tyrannical regime? Do you think people believed that that was really the case?
Well, no. I mean, Iraqi people, they thought, let me tell you, I mean, what we think in general. We thought that Saddam Hussein was supported by the Western government. He was supplied by weapons of mass destruction by Western government, especially during the Iraq-Iran war. He was used against the neighbor country, Iran, to weaken, in the end, to weaken both countries, Iraq and Iran. So have they, and you can hear that from many Iraqis, have they chosen to change Saddam? They could have done that in a different way. But they did not. And there are many examples around the world. We can, I mean, look at Spain. General Franco was in rule. He was ruling the country. He was a dictator. He caused a civil war. He was one of the reasons. He was leading an oppressive regime. Yet in Europe, because it was in Europe, the road to democracy took different paths altogether, different way.
Absolutely.
It wasn't invasion. It wasn't war. It wasn't sending armies of 30 countries to the country, but it took a different path altogether. And we were keen, or we were hoping, to have something similar, to strengthen Iraqi people, to make them really do the change and take it themselves.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't happen.
Yeah, well, you said in your book that the U.S. confused the need of the Iraqi people to get rid of a tyrannical regime with the right to impose a new colonial order, which is what you say has happened.
Yes, that was one of the main issues, really, because they were surrounded, the U.S. administration, what they did is they helped to establish groups outside Iraq, what's called the Iraqi opposition to Saddam's regime. And those people, they were singing the songs that the U.S. administration wanted to hear, saying that, well, Iraqi people are going. And I'm quoting one of them who is a professor at one of the American universities called Kenan McKee. I'm quoting him. He was asked on the eve of the occupation by the President George Bush at the White House. He was there with Condoleezza Rice. And he was asked, how do you think Iraqi people are going to receive us, receive our armies, our troops? And the answer came from the Iraqi, what's called professor. He said, well, they're going to receive you with the sweets and flowers.
Mm-hmm.
It did not happen.
No, indeed.
I don't think American people will receive, now they had a taste of the kind of government they have, if any other power coming from outside the country to occupy them, to change the Bush administration, they're going to receive them with flowers and sweets. I don't think American people do it. I don't know how they thought that Iraqi people will do that. You don't confuse dictatorship with occupation.
That's right. I mean, that was part of the propaganda.
Yeah.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Iraqi novelist, artist, and political commentator Haifa Sangana. Now, the 2003 invasion, you say, promoted colonial feminism. Tell us what you mean by that. And you say that it's irrelevant to most Iraqi women today.
Yes. It's exactly like 3 months before the occupation of Iraq. Suddenly, the U.S. administration realized there are Iraqi women. And there are Iraqi voices missing. And they did not give enough platform to tell the American people how willing Iraqi people to be liberated. And suddenly they realized there are Iraqi women who suffered under Saddam's regime. Obviously, I mean, many of those women really suffered under Saddam's regime. But we've been struggling, trying to reach the media, trying to have access to be heard by the U.S. administration or by the British government or otherwise to tell our stories. But no, we did not. We have not been offered any space, only before the occupation. And suddenly, like 50 Iraqi women were gathered quickly in Washington. They formed an organization called Women for a Free Iraq, and the gathering and the establishment led by the Foundation for Defense of Democracy, part of the establishment altogether here, and also financed by the U.S. administration. Those women, they were touring, they were talking. Within 1 week, they almost gave 200 press conferences, photo opportunities with the U.S. administration, and they were telling stories how horrible is Saddam's regime, about the dark rape rooms, about the torture they were subjected to, and all these stories which have been manipulated by the U.S. administration. And then this organization, mother organization, gave birth to various organizations. This group of organizations moved with the occupation inside Iraq. And they carried on the same propaganda, the same policy of the U.S. administration, and which has nothing to do with the reality of Iraqi women. Like when Iraqi women in cities like Fallujah, where 70% of the city almost demolished, none of those, what I call colonial feminists, spoke about the Iraqi woman tragedy. Or when there are 1 million civilians being killed, none of them raising a voice about those male relatives being killed or detainees or the missing, nothing. Mm. You cannot hear anything about this. What you hear about two things. It's running workshops and having conferences outside Iraq for the practices, to train Iraqi women on the practices of women leadership or women leaders or the idea of democracy. And they are more or less, they're spending most of their time outside Iraq, touring, speaking to represent represent the U.S. administration policy rather than Iraqi women inside Iraq. So the gap is huge, and no wonder, I mean, they did not gain any ground within Iraqi women. But the danger of it, of course, because they are supplied with a huge amount of money, like the ex-ambassador, Paul Bremer, he allocated $750 million for NGOs, in particular women organizations. And those are active in a way to kind of, they're acting like gatekeepers, or any genuine NGO can grow organically inside Iraq. Mm-hmm. I'll give you one example. Before what's called the election inside in Iraq took place, within 2 months before the election, we witnessed the birth of 2,000 women organizations. These 2,000 women organizations, sponsored by the U.S. various organizations and the administration, and immediately after the end of the elections, they disappeared. They evaporated nowhere after getting all the money and the finance, and they disappeared. The sad thing, of course, their work giving very bad reputation to genuine NGOs and to genuine women organizations, and in some cases our women activists are in real danger, because any women activist nowadays more or less seen by Iraqi people as part of the occupation agenda.
Mm.
So they should be killed, or as part of the resistance to be killed. So they are putting great danger on genuine women activists.
Now, I want to talk to you. We are going to run out of time. So you were part of a group of over 100 Iraqi writers, artists, and academics in exile who got together to discuss the future of Iraq. Now what did you guys conclude? What is the future once this war is over?
Well, we conclude that real change can only be brought about by the Iraqi people themselves within the Middle East. And the Middle East is related also to what we see it is part of our huge problem, historical problem, is the Palestinian issue. And we are not going to see any peace in the whole area unless there is justice, and justice for the Palestinian people and Iraqi people. We all want democracy, but not this kind of democracy we are witnessing now. We struggled for many decades trying to establish a human right. We were at the receiving end of the oppression, brutality, torture, and all that, and we thought we're going to put an end to it. So any change, it has to be from inside Iraq. Any change from any help from the outside world, it has to be on equal footing, equal respect of the independent Iraq, unified Iraq, not a fragmented, and human rights as it should be, and that includes women's rights.
Mm-hmm. Now you've lived in London since 1976, and as a novelist and an artist, are you ever very far away from Iraq and its continuous struggles? Is all of your art focused on this still?
Well, I'm not really. I feel I've never left Iraq. And sometimes while I'm walking in the streets in London, I turn around and I look around me and I see Baghdad. I think I'm walking in the streets of my city and my old areas, and I see the faces of people. I think, well, here is my people. I don't think I've ever been able to leave Baghdad or Iraq in general.
Mm-hmm. See, you've lived over half your life in exile. So do you think you ever really could go back if the country changed?
Definitely. I mean, that was the whole idea, and this is what we all aim to do. Most of Iraqis in exile now who cannot go back, and they were dreaming of for so many decades. We want to go back to take part in the building of the country and pay our respect and appreciation to our people.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, Haifa Sangana, thank you so much for talking to us. We are running out of time, and I want to say again to my listeners, please pick up a copy of City of Widows, an Iraqi woman's account of war and resistance. It's really well worth reading. And thank you so much, and good luck to you in the future, Haifa.
Thank you. Thank you very much for listening to me. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. We are supported in part by the Arts of the Southern Finger Lakes in Corning, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. We'll be back next week. I'm Tish Perlman.